Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Weston. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Major Rick Ballas, and I represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Weston, in this appeal. Chief Judge Affron, with your permission, I'm going to ask that 3 minutes of my time be reserved for rebuttal.
Please proceed.
This is a case about protecting service members from the unreasonable searches of their homes. The lower court erred in deciding that the holding of Georgia v. Randolph should not apply to appellant's case. Georgia v. Randolph should apply for the following reasons. First, the facts in Georgia v. Randolph and appellant's case are nearly identical, but for the location wherein the request to search colloquy occurred. Now, the position advocated by the government and adopted by the lower court is to take the narrowest of readings of Georgia v. Randolph, in which physical presence becomes the determinant factor in the analysis. If that is the case, then the analysis is essentially a geography question, wherein a service member who happens to be as fortunate enough as Mr. Randolph was to answer the police's knock on the door has a valid Fourth Amendment claim, whereas the service member who's asked for the same permission to search, but that colloquy occurs in that service member's backyard while he's tending to his garden or gathering up the morning paper at the end of the driveway in the morning, loses out. Appellant submits that the Supreme Court would never have a person's Fourth Amendment rights.
What is the correct analysis then, Randolph?
A more reasonable reading, Your Honor, in which widely shared social expectations are used. Justice Souter, writing for the majority, stated that in determining the reasonableness of consent searches under the Fourth Amendment, great significance is to be afforded to widely shared social expectations or social customs. If that is the test, then, Your Honor, and appellant submits that it is, then
in all seriousness, social customs that pertain to law enforcement searches, or what social custom are we trying to discern here?
What would a reasonable third-party visitor think, Your Honor? And if that is the test, as appellant advocates, then some consideration should, yes, be given to physical presence, but more consideration should be given to whether an objection has been voiced and whether that objection is timely. Appellant submits that the question to be asked by this court this morning is, what would a CID agent reasonably think after having summoned appellant from his marital home on what was a normal school night, family night for the Weston home, watching him invoke his Fifth Amendment rights, objecting to a search of his marital home, and then having Mrs. Weston agree to a search without first informing.
So what would a reasonable CID agent think, or what would a reasonable person in a social context think?
What would a reasonable third party, normal person?
Big difference, right? Someone coming for a dinner party is going to have a different feeling than someone who's a law enforcement officer. Which one is it?
Well, Your Honor, if George v. Randolph is the controlling standard, then I think the language in that opinion is a police officer would not reasonably think that he or she was welcome in the Randolph home. So I guess the test then would be, what would a reasonable CID agent think, Your Honor, with the facts that we have in this record? And the appellant contends that a reasonable CID agent would not think, after again having summoned appellant from his marital home, watching him unequivocally object to a search, having Mrs. Weston agree to a search without telling her that just moments prior her husband has objected, would that CID agent reasonably think that he was welcome in the Weston home to search?
Didn't the appellant go there voluntarily?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Didn't the appellant go down to the CID voluntarily?
Well, Your Honor, it doesn't appear that he was apprehended at that point in time, but whether that was truly a voluntary choice on his part.
Does the appellant maintain that this was a subterfuge by the CID to get him out of there so they could search?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the fallback to our position.
You are arguing that?
The first part of our argument is taking how the appellant got from his home to CID spaces, factoring into widely shared social expectations. Again, you have the CID agents sending a uniformed MP to camp out in front of the Weston Merrill home. As soon as he arrives, he's told his presence is requested. The MP shadows him and his wife as they arrive to CID spaces where they're placed in separate interrogation.
Is there any evidence of record that this was a subterfuge? That they knew, well, in the first place, did they know ahead of time he was going to object? I doubt it.
Nothing in the record.
No, there's nothing. Okay. Well, are you contending this? Are you contending that this was a subterfuge?
Well, appellant's fallback position is, Your Honor, if this court embraces a narrow reading of Georgia v. Randolph, where physical presence is the determinative factor, There is evidence or language in the Georgia v. Randolph decision which talks about if law enforcement officials have removed...
Right, I'm aware of that. But is there anything in this record to show that?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant would submit that these CID agents desperately wanted to conduct a warrantless search of appellant's marital home. And the actions of the CID agents, and again, summoning appellant from his marital home, offering him the right to consult with a criminal defense attorney, and as he's doing that, mid-conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Fricke, his cell phone is confiscated, and he's placed in a detention cell and held incommunicado for 2 to 3 hours, just until the search is over. Those actions, Your Honor, were designed to prevent appellant from in any way interfering with the search of his marital home or for simply getting back in his Ford Explorer, driving back to his residence, and saying, hey, CID agents, I still object. Stop searching.
On your reading of Randolph, if I'm trying to not pick on somebody else, if I'm running a meth lab in my house, is my wife just out of luck? I say I don't consent to any search. So she's stuck with having the meth lab in the house. She can't invite the law enforcement folks in to get rid of the thing.
Well, as some of the dissenters talk about in Georgia v. Randolph, there are other exceptions that may apply. There could be exigent circumstances.
Running it for years, as you well know, and there's no exigent circumstance.
I think there would possibly be a public safety or a public hazard exception, Your Honor.
It's not a meth lab. It's a something peaceful. It's a porn shop.
In that situation, Your Honor, the law...
She's just out of luck. She's got to either cart it all up and put it on the curb. She can't, at which point she runs the risk that somebody's going to finger her.
No, Your Honor. I mean, the law disfavors warrantless searches. All that woman or that spouse has to do is go to law enforcement.
I don't want to have to pick on my wife. But
go to law enforcement.
Wife,
if
she... Go ahead.
Just go to the local police office and simply make a report, and those police officers could conduct a reasonable warrantless seizure while they obtain a search.
And then it will become exigent because I'll be at home busy carting everything out to the neighbor's front yard. This is a preferred view of the law?
Well, the law prefers that warrants or search authorizations be obtained as opposed to warrantless seizures and warrantless searches.
But a well-established exception to that requirement is that if a person who is able to give consent gives consent, that there is no requirement for a warrant. It's as if the other person had given consent. You don't disagree that that's well-established, do you?
That's certainly a well-established exception. However, the facts in this case are we had a disputed consent. Appellant unequivocally objected first, and then undeterred, the CID agents went to Mrs. Weston and obtain consent.
Well, what if they had asked the wife first and she had said yes and then asked the husband and he had said no? Would that change your view of how this case turns out?
It would, Your Honor, and certainly the agents would.
Why is that?
Well, widely shared social expectations, if that is the test as appellant advocates, would a CID agent reasonably think, withstanding with that disputed consent, would he or she be welcome in the Weston home at that point? Simply, if the CID agents had asked Mrs. Weston first and stopped there, appellant would be out of luck.
But what if they had asked her first and she had said yes, and then they asked him and he said no? Does that change things?
That case is, I suppose, a little bit weaker than the facts that we have with the case at bar, because the agents knew first off and foremost that appellant did object, but the CID agents are still facing a disputed consent. And I don't believe the language used by Georgia v. Randolph, the outcome would have been any different had Mrs. Randolph first consented and then Mr. Randolph objected.
But, I mean, in Georgia versus Randolph, the police were confronted with basically a marital squabble on the doorstep of the home.
Yes, Your Honor.
You don't see this as being any different than that?
It is different in that the request to search colloquy occurred in the CID's interrogation rooms as opposed to the threshold to the Weston marital home. And certainly the most compelling case are the facts in Georgia v. Randolph, where you have the objecting co-occupant essentially barricading himself or herself against the door, saying, stay out of my house. But probably the next most compelling case is where you have a service member who would normally have been at home, but for the actions of the CID agents, unequivocally objects, and yet the CID agents persist, go through the wife, take away his cell phone as he's trying to get legal advice, lock him incommunicado in a detention cell, just until the search is over. All of those actions were designed to prevent Appellant from in any way interfering with the search of his marital home.
Is that a finding from the lower court? Is that a finding from the military judge, or didn't they find that none of those actions were designed specifically to keep him from interfering with the search?
Well, Your Honor, the rub there is that the military judge's ruling
came before
Georgia v. Randolph. And Appellant really doesn't take any dispute with the findings of fact by the military judge, but does sort of take issue with some of the critical facts that the military judge did not find, and that is that Appellant invoked his right to remain silent, that he invoked his right to speak with the counsel, that he was communicating with Lieutenant Colonel Fricke, and as he's mid-conversation, his cell phone is ripped away from him, and he's placed incommunicado in a detention cell just until the search is completed. Those are certainly critical facts that would factor into the analysis here on appeal, but the military judge did not make those in his findings of fact or conclusion.
Counsel, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say, given the fact that Georgia versus Randolph hadn't been decided yet and at that time, don't you think that it was good law that either party could consent to a search of the home, irrespective of what the other person did?
That had been the majority view by all the circuit courts that had addressed the issue at the time, and the majority of state courts came in favor of the government at that point.
So any suggestion then that the police were somehow separating the two spouses in order to avoid Georgia versus Randolph would not make any sense, would it?
Well, not exactly, Your Honor. Appellant respectfully submits that the actions of the CID agents need to be looked at now through the lens of Georgia v. Randolph, and that the actions of the CID agents were clearly designed to prevent Appellant from in any way interfering with the search of his marital home. They wanted him not to communicate with Mrs. Weston. They wanted him not to get back into his Ford Explorer and drive home. And their actions in taking away his cell phone, throwing him incommunicado in the detention cell just until the search is over, were all designed to do that, and they were effective in that.
Follow up on that, counsel. There are several different ways of looking at the actions that the law enforcement officials took here, one of which is, as you've suggested, as an interference with whatever rights that he might have under Georgia against Randolph. But my question is, did they do anything which at this stage of the litigation we should see as interfering with the validity of the consent given by the spouse? That is, in what way, if at all, did their actions compromise her consent?
Appellant does not dispute that Mrs. Weston's consent was quote-unquote voluntary, but whether it's valid in light of Georgia v. Randolph, that's what appellant takes issue
okay.
with, Your Honor.
So all of the questions about deception and interference at this stage of litigation did not interfere with the validity of her consent?
Correct, Your Honor. Appellant submits, though, that the actions of the CID agents with respect to appellant certainly impacted his ability to exercise his Fourth Amendment rights to object to the search.
Now, if we had a case where her consent had been interfered with, then we could look at this differently. But if her consent is given in this case so that she can exonerate her husband, which appears to be a rationale that she gave, why isn't that the end of this case?
Your Honor, if I understand the court's question is essentially, was Mrs. Weston's interest aligned with her husband at that point?
No, her own interest. Her own interest at this point was consenting, if her interest was in consenting to the search for the purpose of exonerating her husband, why isn't that a sufficient basis for her to give a consent irrespective of what the husband's interests were?
Meaning that it wasn't even a search, as Justice Thomas in his dissent argued, sort of under Coolidge versus New Hampshire?
That it was a consensual search, and she had a reason for giving consent. And that once she had that reason for giving consent, if that's a valid reason, she wasn't misled or misinformed, because that appears to be the stage that we're at the litigation right now, why isn't that a sufficient basis for the police to then move forward?
It appears, Your Honor, that Georgia B. Randolph holds that when the CID agents have first obtained an objection, that even the spouse's subsequent intent, consent or intent to exonerate her co-occupant spouse gives way to the widely shared social expectations test, which is, would a reasonable third-party visitor think that he or she was welcome, even if Mrs. Weston was trying to exonerate her husband?
So your view...
Exonerate one's husband, a widely shared social expectation?
Your Honor, I don't know. The facts in this case are that the appellant unequivocally objected, made clear that he did not want the agent searching, and that appellant would submit that simply because Mrs. Weston wanted to consent with what she knew at that point in time does not make a CID agent reasonably think that he's welcome in the home.
And then what's the way you would distinguish the Matlock case then in terms of its relationship to Georgia against Randolph?
Yes, Your Honor. The reading advocated by appellant does not undercut either Matlock or Rodriguez because of the factual differences in those cases. Neither Mr. Matlock nor Mr. Rodriguez were ever asked for permission to search, nor did they voice an objection. Appellant clearly was asked for search, and he unequivocally objected. The fine line that Georgia v. Randolph talks about not crossing is not crossed by the reasonable reading advocated by appellant because of the factual differences in those two cases and in appellant's case.
Counsel, just somewhat relatedly, what if they'd asked the wife and she'd consented and they didn't ask Staff Sergeant Weston because they knew without any doubt whatsoever that he would unequivocally and harshly object to a search of the home? How would a reasonable social expectation, you know, the mere fact that they didn't ask him because they knew that the answer would be no, how does that change their social expectations? I mean, as I understand your argument, they would be completely fine under Randolph versus Georgia in that situation, but how is it any different in terms of social expectations if that's the test?
I see that my time is just
Go ahead and answer that question. I'll have one
Your
more
Honor,
myself.
Appellant submits that would simply be smart police work at that point, and that widely shared social expectations would not come into play because the agents don't have that objection from the suspect or the target. It's smart, would have been smarter for the CID agents in this case to simply go to Mrs. Weston, obtain her consent, and stop there. But they chose, for whatever reason, to go to appellant first. He unequivocally objected, and they were undeterred.
And the widely shared expectation you would like us to articulate in this case is that any objection by one spouse is sufficient to halt the police unless there are some other exceptions that might apply, such as exigent circumstances, public safety, et cetera. But short of those, anytime, any place that a spouse objects to a search of the home, that then is binding on the other spouse as well.
When we're talking about the target or the suspect spouse objecting, that's when it should be binding. And obviously the strongest case is the suspect who's standing on the threshold to his or her home. And probably the next strongest case is appellant's, who's been basically summoned from his home, placed in an interrogation room, and then does exactly what Mr. Randolph did, which was object to a search.
What about the physical restraint? That is or is not a criteria for you in this case?
It is a criteria, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Captain Jeff Shills, and along with Colonel Lou Pooley, I represent the United States. The central issue before the court can ultimately be boiled down to one question. That's whether, based on the totality of the circumstances, the search was reasonable at the time the CID agents crossed the threshold into the home. In competing consent cases, what defines the reasonableness of the search are these widely shared social expectations espoused by the court in Randolph.
What is a social expectation?
Well, a social expectation is defined by George V. Randolph, Your Honor, is based on the, or specifically there, based on the social dilemma of competing consents of a husband and a wife at the threshold.
So what is the social expectation in play here? It sounds like a dinner party to me.
Well, in this particular situation, Your Honor, is would the CID agents objectively feel confident to enter the home over the express refusal of appellant based on Mrs. Weston's consent and continuing consent?
So what exactly is the social expectation here?
The social expectation is the wife's consent vitiates the husband's prior objection that took place at CID, Your Honor.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is this might be more appropriately addressed to the Supreme Court and not to you, but what in addition to what is reasonable or unreasonable does social expectation add?
Well, the Supreme Court in Randolph.
Should I be looking at mismanners instead of case law to decide this case? That's what I don't understand.
Well, the Supreme Court specifically stated at the beginning of the opinion, Your Honor, that widely shared social expectations was used in deciding Rodriguez as well as Matlock, and said specifically in Matlock, the common understanding was present when you have the female showing up at the door with a baby at her hip and she shows that she belongs there. And based on this, social expectations establish that you are reasonable in relying on her consent to enter the home, Your Honor. And based on these same social expectations, these are also imputed to the CID officers as well.
Wouldn't it have been more reasonable if the CID would have informed Mrs. Weston that her husband had refused consent?
Well, there is no Fourth Amendment requirement, Your Honor, for the CID agents to tell Mrs. Weston.
No, but we're talking about reasonable social expectations. And if we're looking at reasonable social expectations and the privacy interest involves the home, which is the highest held privacy expectation we have, and where a tenant has expressly refused, and they then go to the co-tenant and say, would you consent, without informing that individual that the co-tenant has refused, how does that play into social expectations? I mean, how would society look at that particular tactic?
Well, potentially, Your Honor, society could potentially say that's unreasonable. But again, in this particular situation, it was not unreasonable. And again, there was no requirement. So based on the law at the time, they were certainly reasonable. And say, for instance...
But we're not... I'm getting more to the social expectations, which I agree is kind of a nebulous concept in this area. But it seems to me, if we're talking about social expectations, you have to factor in how reasonable the request was in the totality of the circumstances. Or do we just ignore that?
Well, no, Your Honor, but in this particular situation, Mrs. Weston was well within her right. She had the authority in herself as a third party to grant consent to the home. So
was it, I guess my question goes to, was it a fully informed consent, given the fact that she wasn't aware that the co-tenant, her husband, had declined it or refused it, which became apparent once the attorney called her up at the home and said, your husband refused consent and you can stop it, and she did.
Well, in that situation, it was not a fully conformed consent, Your Honor. She was not told by the CID agents that Staff Sergeant Weston had previously refused consent. But that issue was not dispositive of the case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It may not be dispositive, and that's what makes this case all these cases have their own unique features to it, but the unique feature here is that although apparently the defense is not challenging whether there is informed consent or not, the question then becomes this one of the social expectations, or just, let's take out the word social, just reasonable expectations as to how we would have the interaction between the law enforcement and the person they're obtaining consent from. In this case, she was not told that her husband had declined consent. She also wasn't told that he was being held incommunicado, not allowed to make phone calls at that point. All information which may well have borne upon whether she would have given consent. If we're talking about social expectations, it's the government's view that a reasonable person seeking entry in a home would not tell the occupant of the home that I've previously been in touch with your spouse. Your spouse refuses, and we've put him in a position where he can't communicate with you. Will you let me in?
Your Honor, CID was reasonable in their actions, and you back to Judge Erdman's question. They were reasonable in going to her and not telling her that. They were reasonable in confiscating appellant's phone. They were reasonable in detaining him based on probable cause. Where George V. Randolph applies these...
But were they reasonable in not letting her know not only that he had refused to consent, but that they were precluding him from communicating with her?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because these widely shared social expectations are applied in Randolph, and they're defined by physical presence at the door, and they're applied to the social dilemma of a husband and wife at the threshold, one saying come in and one saying stay out. And it is there in this situation where the widely shared social expectations are applied. And Georgia V. Randolph, based on the totality of those circumstances, a yes and a no at the house, the court concluded that the search was unreasonable. Here, Your Honor, we have to question reasonableness based on a totality of our circumstances. And that involves a yes and a no at the CID station, followed by Mrs. Weston establishing that she was anxious to clear her husband's name.
Did Mrs. Weston ask whether her husband had consented or had been asked?
No, Your Honor. She did not ask, and she was not told.
Why does the social, if you describe the social dilemma as what to do if the husband and wife are standing at the door arguing over whether you should come in, why isn't that same social dilemma, whatever that means, present if they're on the phone talking to you? They're both on a cell phone talking to you, and one says, come to my house, and the other says, no. Would you show up at someone's house for a dinner party if the wife invites you and the husband says, go away?
Well, I'm hardly what I would consider a reasonable individual.
Do you think that'd be a polite thing to do? I mean, would most people say that was the widely held social expectation that when receiving half an invitation, one would arrive?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because based on that scenario, Your Honor.
I guess we'll look for you on Friday night, you know? Let's try this out. Would you like to come to my house? No, okay. Sorry.
Well, see, and right there, Your Honor, that would have been a physically present consent. The hypothetical you gave involved telephonic consent. They were not physically present, and that would render all the physical
What I'm getting at is why should it make a difference whether they're physically present if you know that you're having the same dispute? They're having the same argument. It's just they're having it 20 miles away at the office.
Well, because then if you have a yes trumps a no, Your Honor, that totally takes the teeth out of U.S. v. Matlock and the two tenets of Fourth Amendment reasonableness, which are third-party consent and the assumption of the risk. There is virtually no assumption of the risk if one co-tenant can say, no, you cannot search the house, and that vitiates a yes.
The Matlock wasn't a refusal of consent to search. It was a non-consent because he wasn't asked.
That's correct, Your Honor. Matlock still lays down, and it furthers the fact that third parties can consent. And again, this is based on the risk, on the assumption of the risk, which has been present in Fourth Amendment law.
Is there a distinction, in your view, between a tenant who specifically objects to a search and a tenant who is not asked, who is then termed non-consenting? Any difference in our analysis in looking at those two individuals?
Well, that analysis would change the way social expectations view the competing consents, Your Honor.
So would society look at it differently if an individual said, no, I don't want you to search my house, as opposed to an individual who was not asked?
Society would look at that differently, Your Honor. However, society would also look at it differently if you had two people standing on the steps and the wife said, come on in, and the husband said, I'm going to punch you in the nose.
But that's not the situation here.
No, Your Honor, that is not the situation here.
I mean, do you think anyone would think it was reasonable if Judge Baker invited you to dinner at his house without having asked his wife if it was okay to bring you?
I think that's more than reasonable, Your Honor.
Okay. You were talking about the assumption of the risk. Are you talking there about just the whole bedrock of this third-party consent rule, which is that you run the risk that someone else will share the fruits or crimes or whatever that you have in the house if they're able to allow the police in?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And I mean, I frankly, I'm not a sociologist and I'm not Ms. Manners, and so I have a little bit of trouble squaring George versus Randolph with that line of cases. Can you do that?
Well, George v. Randolph does reference the Matlock holding, which is based on the assumption of the risk, and it acknowledges that shared tenancy carries with it an assumption of the risk that the co-tenant will grant authority to consent to search. And again, that is the main tenant upon which Matlock is decided.
And Georgia versus Randolph doesn't do anything to take away from that bedrock principle, does it?
No, ma'am. No, Your Honor.
I mean, and again, I don't claim to be able to reconcile, you know, the language about the social mores and social expectations in George versus Randolph with the simultaneous failure to say Matlock is no longer good law. But on the other hand, George versus Randolph seems to me, at least, to be written with a very narrow holding.
Well, that's exactly what it is, Your Honor. And Randolph said specifically they don't want to undercut Matlock. And while they don't base its holding on the assumption of the risk, the fact that it is a very narrow holding with two co-tenants present and objecting contemporaneously at the scene to be searched, that in itself does not limit the assumption of the risk, does not remove the assumption of risk from the Fourth Amendment analysis. And the Supreme Court specifically said at the very beginning, they said when in criticizing the dissent, Your Honor, they said that the question here is whether a search with the consent of one co-tenant is good against another standing at the door, and they said that on multiple occasions. So not only do these wildly shared social expectations apply narrowly to the totality of these circumstances in Randolph, but the court specifically throughout acknowledges that it is presence at the scene upon which the holding is rooted.
Now, they did... I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I thought at least that they had an exception if the person had been removed from the house for the purpose of keeping them from squabbling at the door. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. However,
so what in the facts of this case here have it fall in or out of that exception?
Well, the court specifically required some evidence of as Judge Stuckey put, a subterfuge, essentially, some evidence that he was removed specifically for the purpose of avoiding his express refusal, and that just simply is not
true. Why did they take the cell phone away then? Was he being arrested at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. He was already in the process of being detained based on probable cause, and at that point, appellant unilaterally whipped out his cell phone and started making phone calls. And certainly, you know, there's an obvious problem there. He could be calling a buddy of his to go to his house, say the cops run away, go destroy the evidence. But moreover, appellant does not have a right to a phone call, he does not have the right to grab his cell phone on the way to the detention cell and start unilaterally making phone calls. That is not within his rights. So
didn't he make a request to consult with an attorney?
He did, Your Honor. And again, he has the right to an attorney, but he doesn't have a right to an attorney right there on the spot. So again, this just goes back, again, to the reasonableness of CID in these circumstances. And again, Judge Ryan, George v. Randolph didn't even exist at the point in time, so there was no reason to remove him for purposes of avoiding his objection when the four federal circuits that have previously decided the issue of competing consents have all held that the yes trumps the no, and all of those cases occurred at the threshold, not even at CID.
After after he invoked his rights at the provost marshal's office and said that he was not going to answer any further questions, was it then reasonable for the CID agents to continue questioning him? Because it was after he invoked his rights that they asked whether or not he would give them consent. Is that not correct?
Your Honor, I do not remember specifically which order those two.
Well, let's just assume then, for purposes of my question, that he invoked his rights. At that point, should not questioning have ceased?
Certainly, Your Honor. But of course, nothing resulted from that questioning anyway. So there's no prejudice in that particular situation. He still refused consent to search, and at that point, they went to Mrs. Weston and gained her voluntary consent. And again, it bears noting that in George v. Randolph, based on the totality of those circumstances, it was limited to at the door. Here, in our particular case, we have her consenting. We have her obviously expressing that she was anxious to exonerate her husband. She believed he was innocent, and she believed he did nothing wrong. She knew if she would get the CID agents to search the home, that they would find that there was nothing wrong. She brought them to the house. The appellant was not there. She invited him over the threshold. She allowed them to ask the kids questions. Based on all of these circumstances, Your Honor, the search was reasonable.
Now, I think this has been asked before, and I'm not sure whether it's fair to ask you the question, but what is the importance of being at the threshold? What difference does that make as opposed to both being at the CID office?
Well, Your Honor, it is the physical presence at the threshold that defined the widely shared social expectations applied in George v. Randolph. And again, it is this social dilemma.
Okay. And then let me just follow up on that.
I'm not laughing at you.
Doesn't...
Or you.
Does that social dilemma go away if they're a block away?
If they're not present at the scene to be searched, that particular social dilemma does not apply, Your
Honor. So it's gone.
In that particular situation, it is, Your Honor. However, what exactly constitutes the threshold or at the door in George v. Randolph is a case-specific factual determination to be applied by the court. However, what is clear from the facts of this record are CID spaces at the provost marshal office are not what George v. Randolph considered for.
I just want to make sure I'm clear. It's the government's position that, and this is Randolph, that if in fact there is a dispute at the threshold, there is a social dilemma.
As described by George v. Randolph, yes, Your Honor.
But if that takes place a block and a half away between the husband and wife, or they disagree, that is not a social dilemma.
That is a different social dilemma that would require a different social dilemma analysis.
And what would the difference be?
Well, the difference
is a different social dilemma because it's a block and a half away, but why is it not the same social dilemma, just in a different location?
Because there isn't the physical presence of the objector standing at the threshold.
Is the social dilemma, in your view, in the one that they're arguing about and in the other that they just have given different statements regarding consent?
Yeah, I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
Well, it seems to me that if there is a distinction, and I want the appellant to decide what the social dilemma is, too, but if they're at the threshold of the door or wherever, they're on the porch or whatever they're doing, and they're arguing, that's a dilemma. It's an argument dilemma. If they're in two different places giving consent or non-consent, the dilemma may be that they've given opposite answers, but they're not having a fight. Is that the dilemma? It's a question.
Yes, Rob. The dilemma would be the competing consents, one saying no, one saying yes.
But that's true a block away. The only thing that's different if you're at the threshold of the door is the possibility that the spouses or the co-tenants can get in a fist fight or something. But if they're a block away, you're still having consent and non-consent.
Certainly, Your Honor, but the location still changes the analysis applied to these widely shared social expectations.
Okay, I understand your answer.
Well, the question about the dilemma that's been posed is this the dilemma from the point of view of the police officers? That is, they're faced with a dilemma at the threshold if they have two spouses disagreeing. So the dilemma there is one of the police officer, whether he or she can or cannot come in. Is that the dilemma we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so then the next dilemma is, and your time's up, I'm going to ask a few more questions. The next dilemma is whether they've each given a different answer, but they don't know. That is, the two spouses don't know the different answers. And again, it's the dilemma of the police officer. What do I do when I have two different answers? Is that the dilemma we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, we're facing competing consents.
Okay. Then what do we do in a situation where the dilemma is caused by the police? That may or may not be this case. That is, where the one spouse wants to communicate to the other a concern about the consent, and the police are preventing that communication from happening. Whose dilemma is it then? Is that a dilemma that the police officers are facing that's caused by a disagreement between the spouses, or is that a disagreement that's created because the police officers won't let the spouses communicate with each other?
Well, that's not a dilemma created by the police officers, John. The police officers merely requested consent. And the fact that one said no and one said yes, and again, this case or any other case, Your Honor, is not a dilemma created by the police
officers. And if the police officers preclude them from communicating with each other, and I know you're not conceding that in this case, but if that were the case, that wouldn't make any difference?
No, Your Honor, because again, they still have the third party consent, and she's well within her right to grant that consent. And again, the reasonableness goes to the totality of the circumstances, and the fact that in this case, she was readily apparent and readily willing to take the CID agents to the home across the threshold, help them conduct the search.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Further questions, Your Honor? Respectfully request this court narrowly construe joining the Randolph to the facts of the case. Thank you.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
We do, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question without using the word social or dilemma? please say why it was not reasonable for the police to search the house when the wife said, sure, search the house.
Because the CID agents first knew that appellant exercised what is perhaps one of the most vital constitutional rights, and that is to be free from an unreasonable search of his home. And that was unequivocally communicated to the CID agents, and undeterred, they continued to try and conduct a warrantless search of appellant's marital home, and their sole means of doing that was through Mrs. Weston's consent. Now, the Supreme Court has held that if that colloquy, meaning there's one that says no and one says yes, come on in, if that occurs at the threshold to a person's home, somehow, and I won't use social dilemma, but widely shared social custom, expectations, mores, what have you, say that that third-party visitor should not feel welcome. Appellant submits that that third-party visitor should also not feel welcome when that disputed invitation has occurred in CID's interrogation rooms a block and a half away from the marital home. I mean,
at trial.
I'm sorry,
at trial, after the effort to suppress was non-availing, the accused testified in detail that he had done it and that he did it and that he knew it was wrongful,
yes,
and so
sir.
Forth. Why doesn't that render any error in applying Randolph here almost beyond reasonable doubt?
Well, it would certainly have changed the dynamic of the course of the case, Your Honor. At this point in time, the appellant was confronted at trial with evidence of his misconduct in that the images were presented to the members. Had those images been suppressed, it's more than likely that appellant would not have taken the stand and would have simply asked the government to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And if it had no images, that would have been a very difficult case to prove.
Okay. What about inevitable discovery?
Yes, Your Honor. Very briefly, appellant submits that the lower court's opinion embraces a could-have-would-have approach. That is, that these CID agents could have done X, could have done Y, might have done Z, when in reality, the appellate court should be looking to specific facts in the record and citing to what the law enforcement officials on the night in question
were doing or would have done. And this record shows scant, if any, evidence to establish that these CID agents were aware of the warrantless seizure tactic, would have conducted a reasonable warrantless seizure of the Weston marital home, were aware of the procedures for obtaining a search authorization application, could have put that application together in a timely
Counsel,
manner.
Counsel, what case stands for the proposition that it's the responsibility of the government to prove any of those things on inevitable discovery? That is, does the government have to conduct a law enforcement exam of the agents and prove that they know something about probable cause?
Your Honor.
Isn't it the responsibility of the court to look at the objective facts that were known to the officers at the time and then for the court to determine whether there's inevitable discovery or not?
Yes, Your Honor, but the government has to put some facts into the record to establish what the agents were doing or would have done. Otherwise, everything becomes inevitable, because in today's world, every CID agent or agent at some point has an email or a cell phone or a satellite phone where they could communicate with a trial counsel or an SJA. Appellant submits that if the government has that evidence, all it simply has to do is say, these are our procedures for conducting warrantless seizures. Here's what we've done in the past, and here's what we would have done on the night in question with the facts that we had, and this is why we think we could have obtained a search authorization.
Didn't they eventually obtain a search authorization?
They ultimately did, Your Honor, 29 days after the night.
Well, what's that got to do with it?
That's the only...
No, what I'm saying is, does 29 days prove they're incompetent?
Yes, Your Honor, that's the only evidence appellant submits that the record shows as to the agent's ability and skill in obtaining a search authorization. And it took Agent Grimes 29 days because he'd never done one before, 6 tries to get the wording right because assistance from the law center was not readily available, 7 tries to get on the general schedule to present the search authorization. So appellant submits that inevitable discovery should not save the government's search in this case, and that the evidence should have been suppressed.
At that point, wasn't the computer secured?
It was, Your Honor.
So was there any hurry?
Well, certainly the
sense of... What's wrong with them taking 29 days to cross all the T's and dot all the I's and do it in an extra careful fashion?
Your Honor, the government is sort of wearing the proverbial white hat, should act with due diligence once it's taken someone's private property away. However, more importantly, the only evidence we do have in this record as to what the agents were capable of doing came from Agent Grimes, and his testimony is it took 29 days to put a search authorization application.
Is it a question of what they were capable of doing or what they knew?
What they knew and what they would have done, Your Honor. And this record shows scant, if any, evidence that they were aware of the warrantless seizure tactic or that they could have put that search authorization application together in less than 29 days. I suspect they probably could have done it in less than 29 days, but the question becomes what would be reasonable and what would they have done with these facts in this record. I see my time has long since expired.
You can conclude.
The government submits that the evidence seized from the Weston Merrill home should have been suppressed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We appreciate the presentation by both counsel today, and the court will be in recess until 10:25 a.m.